Hello, I'm the Bunny Man, and welcome to the first Creepy Readings. Today's Creepy Readings are going to revolve around college. Since it's almost fall and the haunting season, so a lot of people are either indoors or hanging out in the quads, enjoying the weather and the falling leaves of their beautiful campuses. Today we're going to go around the United States and go to 4 different campuses. So pull up your favorite beverage, sit back and relax, and let's start the stories. Story number 1. The Glowing Specter. Co-ed dormitories with 24-hour visitation policies were unknown on college campuses in the early 20th century, and curfews were strictly enforced, especially on conservative Southern women's college campuses. So it was that on February 2nd, 1908, sweet Condi Cunningham and several of her girlfriends were up late at night cooking fudge on a stove in the kitchen of Main Hall, then as now a woman's residence at the notable University of Montevallo, about 35 miles south of Birmingham, Alabama. The girls weren't quite finished with their creation when the call came for a lights out. Hurrying to clean up the kitchen because there was strict punishment for violating curfew, one of Condi's friends accidentally tipped over a bottle of cleaning alcohol, spilling it across the stove. The highly flammable liquid quickly burst into flames, then it oozed onto the open burner. The girls feverishly tried to smother the flames, but somehow Condi's housecoat caught on fire. She ran screaming from the dorm. Her friends managed to reach her in the hallway and smother her burning clothes, but not before Condi suffered fatal injuries. She died 2 days later in a local hospital. And now, for more than a century, the anguished ghost of Condi Cunningham has been heard crying for help in Montevallo's old main hall. An unlikely few have even encountered her vaporous form running through the building, wrapped in a glowing such as that cast from a fire. That's the legend behind the most specific of at least 6 ghost stories passed down through the decades on this campus, celebrated for its red brick streets and for being one of the few colleges in the nation whose central grounds have been designated a National Historic District. Founded as Alabama College, a state educational institution for women only, the state did not admit its first male students until 1956. Several years later, it was reorganized and renamed the University of Montevallo, after the small town of some 4,200 people that had offered its enthusiastic civic support when the campus was first established in 1896. The 160-acre college grounds, designed by the Olmsteen brothers. Brother Frederick planned New York City's Central Park around several antebellum homes already in the area, including the 1823 Edmund King House and Reynolds Hall, a Georgian brick house built in the 1820s and used as a Civil War hospital. Both the King House and Reynolds Hall also harbor ghostly manifestations, but poor Miss Cunningham's is Montevallo's saddest specter. When I was a first student here, we thought it was made up story, remembering Mary Frances Tipton, the retired head librarian, author of the school's centennial history, and a graduate herself of the university. We loved to scare each other with it. We even reenacted it when I was an upperclassman for the incoming freshman. All we knew is that the girl in the story had burned to death. Although some of the classmates claimed to have seen the ghost in Main Hall, Tipton never met the elusive Condi. What I would hear is that they saw something out the corner of their eyes that looked like a flash of red or of flames, but then they looked at that direction and nothing was there. But still, Tipton thought the whole story had been fashioned to thrill unsuspecting newcomers. Ghost, horrific death, occasional appearances, and all until she reached the campus as an employee some years later. One of the professors did research for a history of the school. She hadn't been a student here and didn't know the ghost stories. Well, as soon as the book came out, I started reading it. She had found in the Board of Trustees minutes an account of a student being killed. Even the girl's name, Condi Cunningham. Well, I nearly fell over, Tipton said. The trustee's record was familiar to the campus legend of how the girl met her tragic death. Tipton was amazed that the ghost story she first heard as an undergraduate was indeed based on fact, and that it was still being handed down generations to generations after nearly a century. The tragedy had an impact on school policies. I talked to an elderly alumni, and they said they remember how strict the school used to be about cooking in dorm rooms because of a fear that someone like Condi's death might happen again, Tipton said. But is there any real truth in this sad ghost tale of a young co-ed's continued presence at the scene of her dreadful fate? Before its modernization, some years ago, the four-story colonnaded main hall had the atmosphere of many old brick college buildings thrown up in the late 19th century. High ceilings, tall windows, and heavy oak doors with transoms over the threshold. That dormitory was a spooky old building, Tipton recalled. It's that fourth floor that seemed to have the eeriest feelings about it. We didn't know where Condi lived, and that's where the door was. The door. Condi's door, some called it. The door with the inlaid image of what some perceived to be a girl suspended upside down, her long wavy hair cascading to the floor. The door from a room on the fourth floor that the university finally removed from its hinges and put in a locked storage room because so many people were troping through the hall to observe the odd likeness. I've seen it, Tipton said, and it's strange looking. But Tipton is quick to add that despite the campus legend, the door is most probably not original to the building. It was not in place when Condi Cunningham lived there. There is no evidence to suggest the room from which the door was taken might have belonged to her. Not long ago, resident assistants guided several undergraduates to the storeroom where the peculiar dorm is kept, tilted against a wall in the small, dusty space. Some students claimed the door seemed warm to the touch, so others reported a presence when they walked into the room. The image itself is indistinct, a matter of individual belief more than photographic portraiture. Yet students continue to be curious about Condi's story. One resident assistant said her charges insisted they hear doors opening and closing late at night, where no one should be, and sometimes, in an otherwise silent and empty, darkened hallways, there are those muted cries for help and quick footfalls as if from slippered running feet. In Reynolds Hall, one co-ed says she was kicked. A young man claims that he feels the air currents change in the historic building. A spirit roams those hallways, he says. Ghosts in college theaters are as plentiful as aspiring actors in Hollywood, and the University of Montevello is no different. It has two of its own resident stage shades in two separate theaters. Henry Clay Reynolds might be one of the ones prowls the studio theater in his namesake, Reynolds Hall, the second oldest building on campus, an exquisite example of 1850s Southern antebellum Greek Revival architecture, now used for alumni and student organization offices, a 175-seat performance space in use since 1923. I had sensible faculty members tell me that strange things have happened in that building, said Mary Frances Tipton. A good friend of mine was a chairman of the theater department. He is not an overly imaginative man, but he said that when he was there late at night, windows would slam up and down, doors swing open, and in the attic above the stage, there are all sorts of noises. But I don't think he even actually saw Captain Reynolds. Captain Reynolds was a Confederate Civil War soldier, a successful Montevello businessman, and the person state officials turned to in 1896 as the school's president at the last minute when the original choice to head the school, noted Alabama educator Julia Twitwiller, who had the innovative idea to establish an Alabama college for women only, declined the position. She didn't think the state was committed to adequate funding of the new campus. Reynolds had a great idea to do with the success of the school, Tipton noted. Although we're state-strapped, the legislation had done very little to get us help. Reynolds used his business savvy, political connections in Alabama and Washington, D.C. to pin down funding for the school. It's generally believed that had Reynolds not been successful, Alabama College might have folded within a few years. But the story of Henry Clay Reynolds does not end on a triumphant note. The college's board of trustees accused him of mishandling student funds, and he resigned the presidency in 1899, just 3 years into his tenure. It seems Reynolds owned a dry goods store in the city, and officials said some of the school's money was being spent inappropriately at the store for school supplies. There were also accusations of improper bank loans and other charges that eventually resulted in several lawsuits and Reynolds' subsequent resignation. I don't know if there really was mismanagement or not, librarian Tipton conceded. But it was a shame that he left such a bettered man. He really was responsible for the success of those early days. According to most accounts, he moved to Florida and never returned to Montevello. Such an end to what had been a successful and celebrated career certainly might cause Reynolds to still wander the campus building that now bears his name. Tipton thinks that if he does not make an occasional appearance on campus, it's because he left such an angry man. His presidential office had been located in the hall, which decades earlier during the Civil War was an infirmary to treat wounded Southern soldiers. There is no truth to the campus legend that Reynolds was the officer in charge of its use as a hospital. Documents indicated he served as a lieutenant in Virginia campaigns. The second theater ghost is more of what one might suspect, a former drama professor, Walter H. Trumbauer. He was said to inhabit Palmer Auditorium. I knew Trumy, Tipton remembered. He was a darling little man. You just stood in awe of him. Trumbauer was hard to please, but once students gained his approval, they remembered it was a highlight of their college career. Noted for helping heighten the visibility of a traditional February program called College Night, an evening of competitive musical comedy programs entirely acted, written, directed, produced, and designed by students. There are even cheerleaders for each team, with outside professional theater professionals making final decision on the winner. Trumy inspired the students to get more serious and professional about College Night, Tipton said. He really did make it grow. According to campus lore, the final night of College Night often marks an appearance by Trumy, as the concluding performances of each competitive group take place. A baton used to hold lights above the stage will begin to sway gently above the actors who will win. Is he accurate in his predictions? Alas, no one seems to have kept score. Early in College Night preparations, if Trumy really likes what he sees being rehearsed on stage, cast members will see a seat flipped down somewhere in the house. That's the old professor come to watch. As far as can be determined, no one has actually caught sight of the little man. The same cannot be said for another of Montevello's neighborhood phantoms. If a visitor happens to stroll across the University of Montevello's charming grounds late on a cool, misty night and chances upon an old man bent with age, carrying a lantern and a shovel, do not be alarmed. It's only the ghost of Edmund King Jr., dead for nearly a century and a half. King must have been a miserable sort. He didn't trust banks, and certainly didn't have faith that invading Union troops would not strip his property of all his wealth. That's why he is said to have buried a trove of gold coins in a peach orchard next to his residence, now King's House, a centerpiece on the university's ground. Although the orchard is long gone, speculation is that it probably stood where Harmon Hall is now. King was a wealthy Georgia painter who moved to Montevello in about 1850, and later built a Georgian brick house with a wide center hallway and two spacious rooms up and two similar rooms down. The university uses King Hall to accommodate visiting professors and other distinguished guests. But more than a few overnight lodgers there have asserted that Edmund King does not rest easily in the nearby cemetery, where he is buried along with other members of his family. We do not know which room was Mr. King's bedroom upstairs, Mary Frances Tipton says. When the Yankees briefly used the house as their headquarters, King stayed there. He He was old and sick and apparently could not sleep well. Now you can hear him pacing back and forth, not able to sleep. Sometimes you hear the clink of the coins he's counting at his desk. The occasional student returning Coomer Hall from the library has also glimpsed a faint moving light in the upper window of King House. As if from a lantern's glow, a curtain might be brushed aside and then quickly closed. The two other prominent ghost tales on the Montevello campus are a bit murky, shall we say. The figure of an older woman in a yellow dress is thought to show up on occasion, sitting astride on a rock in Main Quad.
That might be Edmund King's first wife, Tipton said. She apparently went through some hard times.
Another tale is rooted in a murder just off campus in the early 1970s. A young woman was choked to death by her boyfriend after she told him she wanted to break off the relationship. He was convicted and jailed. According to one account, the dead woman haunts a shack in the vicinity of where their murder took place, near the campus overflow parking. Librarian Tipton attributes some of the stories to what she terms the ripe imagination of some students. But not all of them, by any means. She is particularly intrigued by Condi Cunningham because of his historical accuracy.
When we found out what her name was, we were able to find a picture in an old annual of a group of girls that included her. She is one of them, but we just don't know which one, because names weren't attached to specific individuals in the picture,
Tipton says. Perhaps it would be sensible to make an enlargement of that photograph and post it in Main Hall, and that way one could say hello to her by name the next time she shows up. Story number 2, Hanging Henry. His name was Henry L. Means. He was a medical student at the University of Vermont, Burlington, during the 1920s. He must have been a perfectionist who suffered terrible bouts of depression because of what he considered his poor grades and his self-described ineptitude with women. It all got to be too much for the young man with such a bright future. On a day after final exams, he climbed the stairs to the attic of Converse Hall and hung himself. The sad irony is that Henry Means would have finished this semester with straight A's. At least that's the story generations of University of Vermont undergraduates have come to appreciate, especially if they live in the castle-like Converse Hall. A brooding 1895 stone pile with a spectacular view of Mount Mansfield from its upper halls. Originally built to house only male UVM students, designed by the architect firm of Wilson Brothers, Philadelphia. The ghost of Henry Means, or just plain Henry, as most Converse Hall residents call their genial, if unseen, companion, is one of the most famous apparitions of any New England campus. The 5-story residential hall looks for all the world like a medieval English castle manor, with its ivy-covered walls and U-shaped Gothic design. A sharply sloped roof with a church-like spires adds to its daunting facade. Air Force and Army recruiters lived there during both World Wars. The mysterious and imposing appearance belies a most modern interior that today serves as a home for university students. And Henry. For most accounts, Henry is a gentle soul, given to mischievous behavior. He'll hide the occasional prized possession, slam some doors, cause the lights to flicker, or announce his presence with quick march footsteps. Particularly fond of proving his existence to those who may not believe in him, as these early written accounts by a university student might indicate. I had a few of my friends were in a room, drinking a few drinks. We started having this conversation about Henry. One of my friends said, I don't believe in him. He's fake. So, we started to make fun of Henry and laugh. Just as he started, we heard this loud footstep, and the door slammed. Then all the empty cans were thrown around the room. That night, we were truly scared. The convenience of having a ghost to blame for all manners of disturbances cannot be overstated. Who is to say which problems is attributed to natural aches and pains of a century-old fortress-like resident hall, and which might be truly the product of a ghost like Henry? In these instances,
collected by a former student of UVM. One is left to decide for oneself where the truth might lie. At one time, Converse Hall housed Mary's students, such as the couple who discovered that Henry might have been a devotee of candles. They wrote of what they discovered. "One of the strangest stories I know, I heard from my sister. This happened to a friend of hers who also lives in Converse. She went to bed early one night with a candle lit on her bedside table. She really loved candles and had them all over her room. Her husband was working late that night and came home after she was asleep. She woke up frequently that night because she felt someone rubbing her nose. The feeling was really waxy. When she woke up, no one was there. Finally, she woke up to tell him, and he thought it was just a bad dream. Later, they both woke up when a mirror on the wall fell down. Now in Converse, back then, the mirrors were bolted right into the wall. Her husband said he couldn't explain it, but they should just go back to bed. The next morning, they found a trail of wax from her side of the bed to the door. Now, my sister isn't superstitious at all, but she saw the wax, and it convinced her." There is a favorite saying in Converse, "Oh well, it must be Henry." It might have originated with this story told a few days after the incident took place. "Frankie, who lives just below me, has been complaining of a noise from my room that wakes her up at night. We tried to figure out what she was hearing, as I am a relatively quiet person. 2 nights ago, I left my room at 3 in the afternoon and didn't return until the next morning. That night, the noise was continuous and sounded, according to Frankie, like all the furniture was being moved around and someone was pacing back and forth. And so what was the answer to the problem? The same explanation you often hear. Oh well, it must be Henry." Halloween has often been Henry's special time, as in this incident, written by one of the participants, when a couple of undergraduates decided to host a children's Halloween party in the hall. "We decided it would be nice to have a party for the kids in town, you know, turn out the lights and make it real spooky. We decided nothing fun ever happened in Converse. We were getting pretty silly and started yelling, 'Henry, will you come out and join us?' As soon as we said that, the lights started flickering on and off. At first we thought it was funny, but we went out in the hall and all the lights were doing it. Every time we said 'Henry,' it started up again. Then we saw the door to the attic being popped open. It was always locked, you see. The door wasn't broken. It just came open. There was a real strong draft. We were scared, screaming and all." Sometimes it's been the smaller, quieter incidences that have led hall residents to think that Henry is out and about, as in this report by a student named Frank. He was active in Converse activities. "I was walking up to Converse and saw the south door open really slow and then close. Just like someone went in, but no one was there. I'm sure it was Henry. Other people saw it too. I was up here with my brother one Sunday afternoon when no one else was around. The whole time we were followed by noises like doors slamming and things being moved. Once Henry predicted a fire. That Christmas vacation, the entire basement was gutted. Henry predicted that no one would be hurt in the fire. The building was empty when it happened." An undergraduate named Becky, described as being intellectual and sensible, took quite some time to be persuaded that Henry did indeed exist. An experience by a friend of hers convinced her otherwise. "Her friend was a freshman. She lived over in the East Wing in a triple room. The roommate's mother died, but she didn't seem outwardly sad. My friend thought this was strange because she was close to her mother and should have been hurt. After the funeral, a few days later, they came back to the room and everything was soaking wet. All the walls were wet, like they were crying. None of the other rooms were wet. It was just like the room was crying." Becky also sensed some strangeness in the room she had been assigned in Converse. "I used to get uncomfortable in my old room. I couldn't explain what it was, but I always felt like he was in there. That's when I started believing in Henry, living in that room. He must like that room. Maybe he lived there." As with many college campus ghosts, Henry adds a personal sense of warmth and belongs to the college scene that may be difficult for outsiders to understand. The college years can be a time of great stress for young people, a time of questioning one's own purpose in life, one's own beliefs, and one's own ability to persevere in the face of academic and personal challenges. Perhaps the confidence that a student from the distant past loves campus so much that he simply cannot leave provides a kind of emotional safety net for contemporary students. At the University of Vermont, Henry might prove that connection, as spelled out by the former students. Of course, I believe. I like Henry. He's pretty good to us. He never hurts us. He reminds me that college is not all academics, and that you must give time to yourself and your friends. That is why he killed himself. That is why he is with us today. He plays with us when we're down, especially at finals time. Without Henry, Converse couldn't be anything. Back in old Converse, it was cold, dark, and spooky, and you could feel him better then, because the renovation didn't change anything, because I still feel him here. All this luxury just hides him better. I'm glad he's here. I'm glad I believe in him. Maybe that's the only reason he lives today, because we believe, or at least want to. And for that, Henry is no doubt grateful. Story number 3. Kennedy Ghost Pledge. Most American college campuses feature Greek organizations for young men and women students. The off-campus houses for those fraternities and sororities are places where students can relax, study, and organize social functions like parties and dances. A couple of campuses, an uninvited ghost or two, may make their presence known. At St. Lawrence University, Canton, New York, the ghost of the daughter of the first president of the university was thought to live in the Pi Kappa Sigma house. Her name was Florence Lee, whose father, John Stebbins Lee, helped St. Lawrence get off the ground in 1856. Little Florence lived in the house as a child until her premature death in 1860. She's been spotted wearing a long, flowing white gown, according to published reports. She'll also slam doors if she's upset with too much social activity or turn off music systems that are playing too loud. Meanwhile, halfway across the country at the University of Louisville, the sisters of the Chi Omega sorority house get along famously with a ghost named George. They know it's a male because passerbyers looking through the large front window at night sometimes notice a bulky figure wearing a suit and standing on the staircase. Just who it is, no one seems to know. In the absence of an identity, back in 1985, someone took to simply calling him George. The Chi Omega women don't live in the house, so there aren't many incidences of nighttime shenanigans by George. He did figure out that he seemed to live on a back staircase that connected with the kitchen, as if someone was tromping along the steps where he heard during the daytime. We just use the house for meetings and stuff. It's a really old house, so no telling how long he's been here, one sorority member reported. She added that she wasn't ever afraid of George, but this well-known presence made for some uncomfortable moments for her. Once, when she was alone in the house, the lights started blinking on and off, his favorite activity. With no one near the wall switches, the plink-a-plank of single notes struck on the living room piano also alerted sorority members that George was about. But like Casper, George was a friendly being. He's never hurt anybody, the sorority member reported. I didn't believe all this when I came here 3 years ago. They just told me we had a ghost, but I didn't believe it. George changed her mind. Story number 4. Poor Mildred. The imposing old brick and stone centerpiece with its distinctive tower on the picturesque Simpson College campus in Indianola, Iowa, a 19th century masterpiece of campus architecture, is known today as College Hall. Planted squarely in the middle of the 1,400-student, 75-acre campus, the hall, as known until the 1980s as Old Chapel, at this college founded in 1860 by members of the Iowa United Methodist Church. An extensive renovation led to its renaming and present use as the home of the admissions office and other departments. But as with many other centers of learning all across North America, Simpson College can find its very own ghost story hiding inside a building used today for deciding corporeal pursuits. A story of a young woman who died too young in College Hall. Her name was Mildred Hedges, a student at Simpson College in 1935. Mildred died in a fall off a third-floor staircase in what was then Old Chapel. Was it an accident, as it was ruled those 70 years ago, or did she commit suicide? The question still reverberates whenever a visitor at College Hall accidentally bumps into Mildred's ghost. A teacher at the time testified that the young girl was starting down the steep staircase with an armful of books when her shoe heel somehow got caught in the hem of her long dress. She lost her balance and pitched headfirst off the staircase. That heartbreaking event was confirmed some years ago by Simpson undergraduate who discovered that the name of the dead girl was Mildred Hedges and that she was killed in this awful manner. She was wearing a skirt well below her knees, the student researcher said. Though fact and fiction have tended to intermingle with the ghost of College Hall, there seems to be a rather strong case that something lurks in the old building. Many students over the years have spoken of meeting the apparition of a young woman on the staircase where Mildred fell. Some years ago, one student claimed the ghost had spoken to her. "She wants to be left alone," she said. A security guard was badly frightened at meeting a translucent figure in an upper corridor. A cleaning lady told a news reporter that she knew mysterious things went on all the time. She said that she and her co-workers constantly witnessed things that could not be explained. Basement lights turning on when no one was around. The third floor lighting blinking on and off in a hypnotic rhythm. Even when the electrical wiring was checked and rechecked by campus electricians. Psychics held a seance in College Hall in late 1979, during which a student photographer may have captured the reflection of a female ghost sitting with the group there that night. When the former old chapel was boarded up prior to remodeling, a number of witnesses claimed to have seen the face of a young woman peering from an upper window of the hall. But the most telling evidence of all are the red discolorations that have been visible on the floor where Mildred Hedges landed after her fall. Some speculate that they are blood stains proven impossible to get rid of. This concludes our first creepy reading. Crazy Susie should be doing a creepy reading also. If you want to participate in a creepy reading and have a story read by either me or Crazy Susie, we'll have the link to our email linked below. Please feel free to email us your stories. If you want it to be read by me or Creepy Susie, please indicate that. If not, just put either. If it's from a male or female perspective, please indicate which perspective it's from in the first line. Thank you for stopping by and hope that you enjoyed this and we'll scare you next time. Bye-bye. Oh.